There hasn't been a lot to laugh about in 2020, but this week's guest reminds us of the power of laughter and good humor, even amidst so much tragedy. She's Gina Brion, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my great friend and colleague, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week we talk about big issues with great guests, storytellers, novelists, comedians, and more to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. This week, we're joined by stand-up comedian Gina Brion, whose new Amazon special is The Floor is Lava. Gina, thank you so much for being with us. Wayne called me about a month ago and said that he and his wife the night before had found your special and had laughed the night away to the point of crying and said, we got to try to get her on. So thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, that's what I want from people. Tears.
Well, you got both. You got laughter and tears.
How did you get into comedy?
Well, I sort of tell the story at the end of The Floor is Lava a little bit, but I can give you the abridged version, which is I became a fan of comedy at 14 years old after watching Brett Butler. Her special Brett Butler sold out on Showtime. I watched that special and instantly I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I was like, I'm going to do that. But really the story started when I was much younger and I just loved making people laugh. I loved making my family laugh. I hated seeing people upset. As soon as I knew I could make people laugh, I just kind of, that was my go-to whenever somebody needed cheering up. And that was the reason I got into it, was to just make people happy. And, you know, till this day, it still is.
What was it about the Brett Butler, though, that resonated with you? Was it just the fact that you realized you could make a living doing this?
No, actually, I had no idea how little money comedians made. I had no idea. I was blown away by the fact that I saw this woman who was incredibly smart and incredibly strong, and she was controlling this room full of people with just her wit. She wasn't yelling at them. She wasn't intimidating them. She was charming and funny and smart, and everybody was so engaged in everything she was saying, myself included. At 14 years old, I sat there like, oh my God, this woman is hilarious and brilliant. And I got all of her stuff. And it just, I had never really seen that happen before. Just, I mean, much less, you know, growing up watching Latino television, you don't see a lot of, I didn't see a lot of women controlling the room like that. A lot of times what I saw growing up was, you know, watching Latino TV was like, you know, women scantily clad and dancing or legitimately dressed up as clowns. I'm not even kidding. My ex's grandmother, who is Mexican, used to call me a payaso or payasa, which means clown. She literally thought I was a clown for a living because she had no idea what a comedian was. Oh, wow. So when you grow up watching that and then you see this woman just being funny, making people laugh, and just so elegantly, I was amazed by it and immediately drawn to it.
So you were born and raised in the Bronx, and a lot of that that background, that upbringing, suffuses your comedy. Tell us a little bit more about your childhood, the circumstances of your family, and just give us a little insight into your roots.
Yeah, I can definitely give you the highlight reel of growing up in the South Bronx. It was tough. But I think when you're from the neighborhood that's tough, you're not as scared of it. I wasn't afraid of my neighborhood, but I knew people that would not dare to venture out to the Bronx. To me, it was the neighborhood that I knew was full of community, was full of family, was full of people that were some of the people stuck in a really crappy situation that were just getting support from other people that were in similar situations. And what I saw growing up was a lot of strength, was a lot of character. And, I had crazy, crazy things would happen. Girls would get jumped. There were fights in my school. There was a metal detector in my school the year that I graduated from intermediate school, not even high school. They put a metal detector in the school. I had a gun pulled on me. Like, there's like a bunch of crazy things that happened that I think give you a different perspective on what's important and a different thing to prioritize. And so for me, I just always had this attitude of like, I have to sort of go for what I want because I knew I needed to prove everybody wrong in a sense.
So at the age of 14, you decide you want to be a comic. It's one thing to decide you want to be a comic. It's another thing to get there. It's a tough road to hoe, is it not? I mean, did you have, must have had failures, successes? How did you go about it? This is one thing that Jim and I are completely fascinated by since we love comedy, but we know little about how you get there. Tell us about that.
It's a long road. That's what I'll start with. It's a long road. I started comedy about when I was about 17, maybe on the cusp of turning 18 years old. If memory serves me at this point, it's been over 20 plus years that I've been doing comedy. And it wasn't until 15 years in that I got my first special. So just to give you a scope of like how much work it takes before you have one big win. There were several small wins, the first one being, the first big comedy club that lets you perform there regularly. That's your first win. And the second win is your first TV gig. And then your second, then maybe you start working the road and you're getting feature work and then you're getting headliner work. And then you hopefully get a special somewhere on some platform, which nowadays is ironically a lot easier, but you have to do it yourself most of the time. There are so many avenues for comics now that I didn't have when I was coming up. Social media was not as big as it was, but because of comics like Dane Cook and Gabriel Iglesias, who I worked with before, who sort of took that email list sort of template and used it. Dane with email lists and MySpace, and Gabriel with Twitter following and everything, turned, followings into ticket sales, which is how you become somebody at that level when you can really turn those followers into ticket sales. But in terms of the business of comedy, in terms of the work itself, when I started, I was relentless with getting on stage. And that's what I tell every new comic I meet. You have to get on stage as much as humanly possible until that stage is your second home, and you're so comfortable up there. You're almost more comfortable up there than you are in real life.
What do you learn in that process of you know, it's just like the 10,000 hour rule I'm thinking about. You know, as a frustrated musician, I have not spent 10,000 hours on anything. But what is it that you learn by being on stage? Do you learn the actual delivery of the joke? Do you learn how to read the room? What is it that you learn?
It's everything. The more you're on stage, the more you learn how delivery and timing work in a joke or in a bit or in a story. There are storytellers and then there are joke tellers. And for joke tellers, for both, it will always be timing. With somebody who's a storyteller, you will have a bunch of jokes within one given story. For somebody who's a joke teller, you'll just have a bunch of single jokes. Like, the best example I can say is like Dave Attell is a joke teller. He has a joke, a joke, a joke, a joke, a joke, a joke, a joke. Whereas you would look at somebody like Eddie Izzard as a storyteller. He loves history. He will tell, more historic stories, but he will always have funny lines within that story. You learn all of this just by getting on stage. You learn what type of comic you want to be, what works for you. You learn how to control the room, or not even how to, not just how to control it, but how to immediately read a room. I can walk into a room and for the most part, I can walk into a room and look around the room and read the room and go, oh, tonight's going to be a good night. Or, oh, I'm going to struggle. And even to this day, just because you're a successful comic at any successful level, whether you're, at my level or Bill Burr's level or Gabriel's level or wherever, when you look at a room, you can tell, oh, these people are probably not going to like me just by reading the room and reading the energy in the room. And I'll give an example. I went to a show years ago. I was performing on a show in Connecticut, and I walked in the room immediately and I was like, oh, they're going to hate me. I knew it right away from the second I saw there was a giant Puerto Rican flag draped on the stage. There was a DJ on the stage. That's too many distractions already for an audience. And I need an audience that pays attention. I need an audience that listens. And if they were that type of audience, I already knew I was going to lose them. And sure enough, 5 minutes into my set, I completely lost them and everything just went nuts.
So what is that like emotionally when you lose a crowd, when they don't like you, or, and this probably applies to you earlier in your career, when you bomb? There must be a parallel sort of track in your mind as you're doing your stand up, thinking, oh my God, this is horrible, or I can't stand. What's that like?
It's different for every comic and yet somewhat the same. We all get frustrated by it. It's in the beginning when you're just starting, it's terrifying. I used to cry after every bad set, but I was a teenager. I was a kid. I was like 17, 18 years old. Of course, I would cry. I was deeply affected by this because in my mind, all I wanted to do was make people happy. And so when they weren't on board with it, I was confused and angered, not realizing that sometimes there's two things happen when you're bombing in front of an audience. Sometimes it's the audience. Sometimes it's you. You have to learn to differentiate the two. There are some comics that are like, it's never the audience. I don't like when comics say that, because that's not true. That's not true at all. You cannot guarantee that every group of people is going to like you. And that's proven by even comics as prolific and amazing as Dave Chappelle have talked about recently bombing, how he recently bombed on a show. Anybody can bomb at any time, no matter how much experience you have. It's about how you handle it and whether or not you can get out of it. And sometimes you can't. When an audience decides they don't like you as a whole, sometimes they just decide that. And you'll have pockets of people. When I get into those situations, I will concentrate on the pockets of people that seem like they're laughing and having a good time just so I can survive the stage time, just sitting up there on stage.
This is a question that I've wondered about. Are there some jokes that one night or bits, or are there some bits that one night will work, it'll absolutely kill, and then the next night, told the exact same way, it just falls flat?
Not usually. That really depends on a few factors. Like, for a lot of comics, we have to watch our delivery of older material. When we're doing older material, sometimes we don't do it with the same energy because we're tired of it. And when we don't perform it with the same energy, it doesn't get the same response. And then there are times when it was just the wrong audience for that particular bit or that particular story. So that's where reading the room comes into play. Like when you walk in and you read the room, you go, okay, maybe I shouldn't do a bit about divorce in this crowd. Or maybe I shouldn't do a bit about kids in this crowd because these are all millennials and they may not care about that stuff. You slowly work it in. Really, it's whatever you want to do on that stage and however you do it, as long as you perform it. I remember Chris Rock was at a party one time, and I believe Stand Up New York, and I heard this through a third-party person, where he was sitting at the bar and some people were around him, and he was talking to a younger comic, and he said, if you don't believe what you're saying, nobody else will. So conviction is a big part of it. You have to go up there and 100% believe in what you're saying, or nobody's going to buy it.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM, satellite radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 19 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Gina Brilliant, an actress, writer, and comedian whose latest comedy special, The Floor is Lava, is streaming now on Amazon Prime Video. You can find Gina on Twitter at Gina Brilliant. That's G-I-N-A-B-R-I-L-L-O-N.
So talk to us about The Floor is Lava, the Amazon Prime special. As I said, I was just totally drawn into that. And I started watching it right before my bedtime, and I'm very religious about my bedtime. One of the few things that kept me on past my bedtime. Just tell our audience if they haven't seen it. And by the way, if you haven't seen it, you got to see it. But give us a quick sort of summary, Gina.
I'll give you a quick summary of both the before and after and during of The Floor is Lava. Because essentially what happened in that time period is I had just finished, or two offers came in at the same time for me to shoot a half hour and for me to shoot an hour. The half hour was going to live on the HBO Latino space. And then the hour was going to be for Amazon. And so my team of people came to me at the time and they said, well, which one do you want to do? And like an insane person, I said both.
Or a smart person.
Yes. Which only gave me 5 months to write an hour special.
Oh, my God.
To write it, perform it, tour with it as much as I could, and just get it down to as perfect as I could in 5 months. So busting my hump for 5 months with my buddy and writing partner, Jason, he would come to shows, he would watch me do my set and sort of let me know, this bit's working, this bit's not working. Okay, this bit worked tonight because you did it this way. So he was observing everything I'm doing on stage to speed up the process of me being able to get this material out. And a lot of it was stuff about my childhood and me growing up. And, you know, so we went and visited my old neighborhood of the Bronx, and we did a lot more work than people even realize to put this together in 5 months. And so once the special was done, and what I loved and what I'm thankful for the people of Amazon and the people at Comedy Dynamics, is that they let me have so much creative control. I mean, everything that you see in that special, from the outfit I'm wearing to the colors that are the stage, that are on the stage, I picked everything out personally. All of my style people, my roommate was my makeup artist. A hair person was the exact same hair person I use for regular everyday things. My outfit was done by a very good friend of mine who has since passed on, but he had dressed me for almost every single thing I'd done on television. I got to pick that core group of people and really control the creative of everything, every aspect of this creatively. And I was so happy with that, because there's not a lot of, you know, people on the industry side of things that would trust an artist enough to let them do all that creative work. They would have their people, you know, to control the situation, but they really let me just kind of live a lot, and I appreciate that. And it has a special place in my heart because of how much work went into it and how much of my personality is actually in every aspect of it.
I'm curious, how do you write? Is it spur of the moment, or do you actually sort of, you know, find time to sit down and I don't know, with a notebook or however? How do you write?
Well, lately, because of both the pandemic and my new mom schedule, I get up around 4:30 in the morning. I take care of my son till about 5:30, and then from 5:30 until my son wakes up again around 7 or 7:30. I am working on comedy. I am working on whatever bits I feel like I can work on more, add more to, or if like tonight I have a show, I'll have a set list that I want to work out. So I'll sit there with my cup of coffee and I will just work until I have to be back on mom duty. And then I'm back on mom duty. And then once I'm off again, it's back to work. And it's working on that. It's working on other projects, but I have to dedicate time to comedy. Some things are spur of the moment. Some things happen and I grab my recorder and I record it or I jot it down. That's always going to happen in comedy. But there is also a part of it that's like the things that are spur of the moment, the things that I jot down, those are the things I'm working on at 5:30 in the morning. and working a couple of hours to make sure that they are as strong as they can be. And I don't really know that until I perform them. And some bits are fine, like really short. And some of them I'm like, no, this needs to be expanded. I can add more to this. And that's the fun part of the creative process. It's also painstakingly boring at times, but once you get to actually execute a well-written bit or joke or story that you put out there, it's just amazing. It's amazing to see what your work can add up to.
So that is such incredible passion and dedication. We see this with a lot of our storyteller guests. So I definitely applaud. It's also really hard work. I mean, it's a lot of hard work. The question I want to ask, you draw on your experiences with real life people in much of your comedy. And one of the people you bring into the comedy is your husband. I'm just laughing about to read this line. You describe him as a 1978 Caucasian and say that he's not just white, he's Midwest white. And then you go off on a riff there. It's it's so funny. How did you guys meet and what does he think of your comedy? Because he obviously knows what you're doing.
He obviously does. He always told me, he said, I don't care what you write about me as long as it's funny.
Well, you succeeded.
It's a good man.
It's a good man. Yes, absolutely.
Which is a great attitude to have when your wife is a comedian.
It's a survival tactic, I think.
There have been a couple of things I've written where I've like been like, oh, I better check with him before. Like one time we had a fight about something, and this was when we were dating. And I called him from the airport and I was like, we got to talk about this fight. And I was like, because I already wrote a joke about it and I'm doing it. So we got to talk about it now. We met on a cruise ship. I was working on a cruise ship. And so was my husband. My husband's an entertainer as well. He's a musician. And he's a musician and a singer. And I was working on the cruise ship in their comedy club. And the comedy club was a shared venue for me and for him, because he did dueling pianos. So the dueling piano show is usually either after the comedy show or in place of the comedy show. So we met just, I think it was like I was on the ship for like a week. I tell the story in the special of having a crush on him immediately. And I did. I had a crush on my husband immediately the second I saw him. I was like, that's the most handsome man I've ever seen. I was smitten and he did not know I was alive. He did not talk to me. He did not really interact with me. But partially that was my fault too, because I get really shy when I like somebody. So I get really like just reserved into myself. Most comics are surprisingly introverted. Like we're just, people don't believe it, but there's so many comics that you have no idea. Big name comics, you know, that are actually introverts that can turn it on and turn it off when they need to. But when it comes to their private time or them off stage, they're very to themselves. And I tend to be that way too. I tend to be incredibly quiet and shy. And then people are like, you're a comic? What? And so I stayed away from him for a while. And then one night we got to talking about comedy. And he was like telling me he had all these comedy specials. And he was like, oh, I can put them on a flash drive and I'll bring them to the show. And I was like, or I could stop by your cabin and like pick them up. However you want to play this, that's fine. And he didn't catch it. It just went over his head. And then one night he was out with his buddies and it was their night off and they actually got to see me perform. And he came up to me after the show and he was like, I've never got to see you perform before. And I just have to tell you, I think you're so talented and you're so funny and you're the most beautiful female comedian I've ever seen. And I went, that's very specific, but thank you. I would have taken beautiful as a compliment alone. But then we were just inseparable from that point on. We started talking about music and I love music. I grew up singing in the church and, I've always loved music and musicians. I've always been amazed by them. So once he started talking music and I started talking comedy and he loves comedy and I love music, we were just kind of inseparable from that point on. And then fast forward, we got married in 2017.
Congratulations. Gina, you know, we've got a few minutes left here and we're nearing the end of 2020. And I'm just wondering, how has your work been affected? Have there been gigs to be had? In the time of the pandemic?
Well, There have been gigs, you know, it's not ideal that we're doing gigs virtually. You know, there's stand-up gigs that are now online. I've done a few of them because I love what I do. It's hard to stay away from what you love. Just, you know, aside from the whole money aspect of the situation is for a lot of comics, it's an outlet that we actually legitimately need, you know, in order to get over our own weird psychosis. Not healthy individuals. We tell jokes for a living. We're not. Let's be clear on that, guys. We need that outlet, and without that outlet, a lot of us started to get and have been getting very antsy, and just like it's very difficult for us not to have that way of expressing ourselves. So a lot of comics I know, especially in, you know, the New York area where I'm based at, you know, we're doing comedy shows in the park, we're doing rooftop comedy shows, we're doing virtual comedy shows. You know, I think tonight is my first sort of indoor comedy experience, so I'll see how that goes. But we're slowly creeping back to some semblance of normalcy, and I don't know what the new normal is going to be, because I think we're going to go through stages of new normal, where it's like this first stage is now all of this stuff, and then the next stage will be when we start to open stuff indoors, and then the stage after that is, you know, moving on from everything we've been through, as long as we don't go through a second coming of all this, which is I hope we don't. But there's going to be several new normals, and I think as a people, we need to accept that, and as performers, we need to adjust to it.
So you're also a writer and a poet, and again, we're running out of time. And I just want to say you're welcome back here anytime because Lord knows we need a good laugh anytime, but particularly now. But talk about your writing and your poetry.
You got about 15 seconds, Gina. Oh.
Okay. I wrote a poem once and it made it into an anthology of poetry. I don't know or remember the book, but I have it somewhere buried. I love to write, and I've been writing more, including embarking on a book project, which will be self-helpy satch comedy. And I hope everybody will enjoy it once it's done. And everything else, blah, 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 blah. Follow me on my social media.
We'll
Well
have you
done.
back when the book, when the book's out, we'll have you back for sure.
Yes.
Gina Brion, the special is The Floor is Lava. People need to check it out. That's all the time we have this week for Story in the Public Square. If you want to know more, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pelscenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.